Sorry, back on topic. I'd fuck Pac-Man so hard. So hard all day, all night. Moving on.
That's the trailer for the show. So yep. Just...
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that gets things done in twice the time, treble the price, and at half the quality. I am half of your hosts. My name is Ben Vanderveld. Let me tell you more about this nonsense. Life, as the great philosopher Avril Lavigne said, is like a roller coaster. But from our point of view, it is a roller coaster that has gaps in the track, a drunk attendant, and will inevitably have you stuck halfway round the loop, while you look down at a tiny template on your car that says, made by Wile E. Coyote. And next to me, in a box marked Acme Podcast Presenters and Co-Hosts, is the wonderful Barry Brett McStay.
Meep, meep.
Hello, hello.
Like you introduced me by my married name.
I did.
As opposed to my stage name.
Yeah, exactly. So our listeners can...
a little insight into my domestic life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Closely guarded secret.
Also, as married names to stage names go, it's not exactly Morris Micklewhite to Michael Caine,
it's
is
not
it?
No, Reg Dwight, Elton John.
Oh, God, yeah. He does. The thing is, without all the spangles, he does look like a Reggie.
Yeah, he does, actually. If you put him in, like, a tracksuit.
Yeah.
In the park with a can of special brew.
I wonder what...
Or, you know, behind the wheel of a minicab.
Yeah, no, I could see him with one of those big, flat New York caps and a minicab. Yes. That'd be such a fun game. I reckon... The thing is, I reckon if you met Michael Caine and called him Maurice, he'd be all right. I reckon if you called Elton John Reggie, he'd fucking lamp you on.
Yeah, I bet. That would set him off on one. You'd have to do it on a Saturday night.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all right, Reggie. This is the time. This is exactly the time for this.
Anyway, enough of this. I should introduce our guest, who is writhing in pain at that overwrought attempt to remember
Joy.
What exactly the title of that song was.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember, was it Friday
Thursday,
or Saturday?
Thursday, Friday.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't sound right.
Friday night is all right for limbering up.
Okay.
Saturday lunchtime is all right for the weigh-in.
Yeah.
Saturday night, all about the fight.
Sunday night, Monday night, recovery.
Yeah.
Cruising all week with you.
Our guest, well, where to begin with our guest this week? He is a writer, director, producer, and performer. Yes, the quadruple threat. He's a graduate of the Distinguished Royal Court Theatre's Young Writers Programme, a writer and performer on the acclaimed podcast sitcom Wooden Overcoats, contributor to Radio 4's The Now Show and The News Quiz, writer on the Cartoon Network's Amazing World of Gumball, founder of his own production company. Wait, I haven't finished what you've done yet.
You don't have to. Okay.
Which has produced a ton of new work, especially London's Vault Festival over the last couple of years. And he's a podcast host himself of the show Story, etc. And as a Crystal Maze host for me, I was also especially excited by his Richard O'Brien connection.
Oh, yes.
You adapted the sequel of the Rocky Horror Show, Shock Treatment, for the stage in 2015. And Google also tells me he is the former curator of anthropology at the Horniman Museum, currently undertaking a PhD at Cambridge with a special focus in the preservation of the heritage of the Kalasha people of northwest Pakistan, a dwindling subset of Vedism. But maybe that's the wrong Tom Crowley.
But it's hard to find the time.
Yes. Here instead is definitely the right Tom Crowley.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, Tom.
Hello, Tom Crowley, or as your stage name is, Geraldo McSweeney.
That's right, yes. But I want to be known by my birth name, Tom
okay.
Crowley.
It's brilliant. I mean, technically, as we all know, your birth name is Tom Hardy.
It is, yes.
Really?
It's an open secret, yes. Tom Hardy. And I looked this up the other day, right? That fucking Tom Hardy, I looked up his birth name. It's Ed.
He
was
Ed
nearly
Hardy?
Ed Hardy, which is the clothing label, right? So he couldn't have that. So he chose Tom Hardy. His middle name's Tom. My full name is Thomas Edmund Hardy. His name is Edward Thomas Hardy.
If the two of you are ever in the same room together, the world collapses.
Yeah, I know,
itself.
Yeah. Or we fight on a Saturday night. I can't tell.
Yeah. You could have done an amazing version of Legend, though, where you're like, we are the brothers.
I could have done a better Welsh accent in Locke, I can tell you that. Have you seen Locke?
I have not seen Locke.
It's really good, but I'll tell you what, that Welsh accent goes proper Indian at points.
We always ask our guests, Tom, what they are the worst at in the world.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this, and I think that I'm the absolute worst comics reader. in the world. And I'll explain that. I used to,
as in comic books.
Comic books, yeah. And I used to...
you're not like a...
I'm a cold reader comedians. I've got you two figured out already, through and through. No, I used to work in the best comic shop in London, Gosh Comics, which used to be in Great Russell Street and is now in at the bottom of Berwick Street in Soho. And I worked there for a couple of years after I left school, before I went to university, and then went back for a while before I went freelance. And so I've always been a huge fan of comics. I absolutely adore them. And thanks to not only sort of having an eye on the trends that was afforded to me by working there, but also having the advice of my friends who still work there, I have a little pull list. You know, so if you've never worked or shopped in a comic shop before, then there'll always be a list. The one in Gosh runs on DOS. I don't think that's a secret because the Windows one is so bad. But the so it still runs on DOS, and you have a little list of comics they'll save for you whenever they come out. And some of my favourites are ones that aren't out very regularly. So Hellboy and anything by Paul Grist, all the stuff I really love. So I'll go in there sort of every few couple of months, and they'll pull out my pull list and I'll be like, oh, more, because I'd assumed nothing would have come out. So I have a stack a foot high next to my bed of all the comics, of unread comics. And I love them, and I always get a huge kick, artistic kick out of comics, and in a way that no other medium really does for me. But still, it's... and the reason is podcasts. Because it used to be that all my reading happened when I was sitting in a cafe waiting for somebody, or if I was travelling, and now that is pure podcast time.
There's a Japanese word called sundoku, which is the purchasing of lots of books without ever getting around to read them.
That's a beautiful term. That's really... Sundoku.
Yeah.
Right, I'll remember that. That's me in comics.
That's basically you in comic books.
Yeah, yeah. And the worst thing is I'll go in and I'll get my little sort of three or four comics from that month or whatever and go, oh, yeah, I'll take the fine. Gosh is especially bad for this, because this is not sponsored by Gosh, by the way. This is just my own personal
yet
plug. Yet. Well, I mean, after this, hopefully they'll send you something.
We are putting this out on the Atari, though.
Oh, really? Oh, great, great. That's good news. That's good news. But yeah, so what they'll do, they have beautiful book buyers and beautiful displays, and so they'll go, oh, that new Sammy Harkin book's out, and I'll go, I shouldn't buy it, and we'll definitely buy it, and then read it on the train. But the stack never changes.
I was subscribed to the National Geographic when I was younger.
Oh, yeah?
In the pre-Rupert Murdoch owning years.
Oh.
And,
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, man, he owns Nature and Science.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's why it's doing so badly.
Yeah, is National Geographic starting to run articles about why climate change doesn't exist and coal is a really good resource?
I haven't read any recently. In fact, I didn't read any when I was subscribed to it.
Oh, no.
I have about 4 or 5 years worth of the yellow magazines stacked up on a shelf at home, where essentially I would flick through them looking for any of the pictures of nude prehistoric man or women contain.
That's why we had
and skip past the articles about the Antarctic.
Oh, I love a bit of Cro-Magnon.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that little occipital lobe.
Oh, my God.
Let me big prefrontal cortex.
Sloping forehead and hairy shoulders. That's what I want.
run your fingers through my back hair.
The new podcast from Barry McStay.
It's weird. I might tell the listeners, I'm slightly ill, so I might be a bit delirious during this podcast.
You sound delightful.
Yeah, I sound better than I did, but I definitely feel a fever.
That's fine. What we're going to do is me and Tom are going to feed you different nodules of culture, like National Geographic, and watch your fevered brain work them into pornography.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. That's the plan, which is what the National Geographic project...
Like a ladder to Toulouse-Lautrec.
That's how I think of myself.
Yes. Yeah, instead of being off your face on absinthe, you're just smashed on Sudafed.
It's basically, it's true.
Just snort a line of the blue stuff.
Yeah.
Show him some...
Fairy.
The blue fairy. That's appropriate for creating porno.
Yeah.
Yeah. True, yeah.
You disgraceful erotic smurf.
You've given away my pet name as well.
Yeah.
Sponsored by Gosh Comics.
Right then, we should get to business. This isn't just fun frippery and goading an ill man.
You promised me it would all be goading an ill man.
That'll be the DVD extras. And by DVD, I mean MP3. And by MP3, I mean I don't understand technology. We outsource all of our editing. We are talking this week about the world's worst remakes. I have a suspicion, listeners, that this is going to be a pretty wide remit.
Yeah.
Because in my mind, that applies to films and films only. But, Mr. Brett McStay, I believe you have wandered outside the city limits on this.
I got a bit lost, yeah. I thought of just general reboots and restarting of things.
Reimaginings.
And reimaginings of things. Napoleon's 100 days, guys.
Right, okay.
Napoleon's are we going straight into 100 this? Days. Hang on, I don't know what this is.
So, do you know when Napoleon was exiled to the island of Elba?
Yep.
When was that?
After 1815, after the Battle of Trafalgar.
At Waterloo, you're thinking of 1815, yeah.
Yeah.
No, no, he was exiled to Elba the year before that. And so the hundred days are when he came back from Elba to sort of reinstate himself on the throne of France.
Guess who's back?
Yeah.
Back again.
Nappy's back.
Oh,
not a good nickname.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, so the sort of the European powers had invaded and entered Paris in 1814 and exiled Napoleon to the island of Elba, which is off the coast of Italy. And then, basically, a year later, the powers had been at the Congress of Vienna, tried to divvy up the Napoleonic Empire between themselves and basically nearly at each other's throats. And Napoleon thought, this might be a good time for me to make a bit of a comeback. I see a gap in the market. Steps are back. Why not Napoleon? And the new Wikipedia article about it very delightfully describes it as, he slipped away from Elba with 1,000 men.
Oh my god.
I don't know how you can sort of discreetly slip away from an island with a small army.
Yeah, under 1,000 fake bushes.
Yeah.
in the ocean.
Yeah, so he landed in Provence, which was very royalist actually, so he had to sort of quickly get out of Provence into the rest of France and rallied loads of people to his side, and then he ended up with an army bigger than what he'd had before.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the army that went on to fight at Waterloo, which he lost. So he got exiled again, and he abdicated after the Battle of Waterloo, abdicated in favour of his son, as if that would have made a blind bit of difference to what was going to happen.
Oh, God. And also, Napoleon's comeback and remake was directed by Tim Burton, so oh, yes. Helena Bonham Carter was at his side the whole time.
Unnecessary sidekick character.
Yeah. As incongruous wench.
Yeah. Hello, my name's Incongruous Wench.
In a different bonnet. It's essentially her
acting.
It's
a black and white stripy bonnet and tights and...
I also looked at... do you remember that fresco of that Jesus in the church in Saragossa?
Oh my god, yeah, that's a great bad remake.
Yeah. For people who don't remember this, this is the Ecce Homo fresco in the Church of the Sanctuary of Mercy in Saragossa in Spain, which in 2012 was restored. It was by an artist called Elias Garcia Martinez. It's about 100 years old, of sort of Christ looking Christ-like and a bit sad. And it's gotten a bit worn. And so an 80 woman in her 80s, a parishioner called Cecilia Jimenez, took it upon herself to try and restore it, leaving it to look like, as BBC Europe reporter Christian Fraser described it, as a crayon sketch of a very hairy monkey in an ill-fitting tunic.
Yeah, it looks like a squirrel monkey if you've ever seen one of them. Specifically. Yeah,
it's. Yeah.
How do you two know that Jesus wasn't actually a squirrel monkey? It wouldn't be the most batshit crazy thing to be in the Gospels.
No, that's true.
Well, I don't know, but Jesus was a squirrel monkey is my favourite Pixies album, so I can't say that.
Would have saved on the wood for the cross.
Yeah. I did not come here to hear to imagine a squirrel monkey being crucified.
Well, welcome to our show. I also looked at remakes of landmarks.
Okay. So like refurbishments, or they've duplicated them?
Duplications.
Right.
So the Chinese are absolutely buggers for this.
Mini Paris.
I'm going to come to them in a second. One of my favourite ones is New London Bridge. So the current London Bridge you have is the new London Bridge. Before we had New London Bridge, and before that we had Old London Bridge, which stood for about 600 years over the Thames. And that's the really cool one, which was made of wood, and there were shops and huts and three-story buildings on it. And
they've set a million Doctor Who episodes on that bridge.
That one was 600 years old, was falling apart. And so they replaced it in 1831 with a new bridge with five arches on it. Within 60 years, it was the busiest thoroughfare in London. It had to be widened by 13 feet to accommodate all the people that were using it. And it was sinking by an inch every 8 years.
Oh, wow.
By 1967, just 130 years later, they had to completely take it down and replace it with the new horrible one that we have now.
This is the new London
Bridge. So this is the one we have now is new London Bridge.
Right.
So New London Bridge in 1967, they had to get rid of. And what did they think they did with it?
Oh.
Did they sell it to the Americans?
They sold it to an American.
Oh.
Yeah. A guy on the council called Ivan Luckins suggested they sell it, and a load of people thought this is bonkers.
Like Piers Morgan? sort of a clapped out old landmark that we sold to the Americans. Yes. And then they gave it back.
Unfortunately, they gave Piers Morgan back.
Damn
the Americans
it.
Have kept New London Bridge. They sold it to a guy called Robert McCulloch, who was an oil man, because they all are, for $2.5 million. And there's a story that he thought he was buying Tower Bridge, which is probably not true, because Tower Bridge is the cool one with the towers and the opens for boats and all that. And it was taken piece by piece through the Panama Canal and up through California to a place called Lake Havasu in Arizona, and it's over a canal.
Arizona.
Lake Havasu in Arizona.
Where hurricanes are the happen.
lives there.
Yeah, and it's over a canal there from uptown Lake Havasu to an unnamed island.
Oh.
Yes.
Now called New Old Bridge Island.
New Old Bridge Island. yeah, and the Americans also have a replica of the Parthenon.
Oh, yes, okay.
In Nashville, Tennessee, which apparently is called the Athens of the South in America.
I don't think I've ever heard of that.
No, I haven't. And surely Athens in Georgia
yeah.
is the
yeah,
Athens
yeah,
of the
that
South.
That would be, yeah.
If we're going to talk about remakes of great landmarks, then the Sydney Harbour Bridge can fucking do one as a remake of my own beloved Tyne Bridge. Because
oh.
I think we can all agree what the greater wonder of the world is.
Yeah, the world stops to look at the New Year's Eve fireworks from the Tyne Bridge.
Yeah, look, it's just one guy from Benwell with a party popper.
I just have one question. It's still good. I mean, I have one question, which is, can you see the Sydney Opera House from the Tyneside Bridge?
I mean, you can see the Sage Music Centre.
All right.
Yeah, that'll do.
That admittedly looks like an amorphous space slug rather than, the beautiful...
I thought we got North Piers Morgan.
Marks. Hey,
call back.
Sorry, can't help it.
That'll do.
As Ben said, if you want loads of replicas of landmarks, you have to go to China. They have a Mount Rushmore in Chongqing.
With the president's faces on, not with just Mao, Mao, Mao and Mao.
Not with Mao, Mao and Mao.
Yeah.
No, it's not quite as tall. It's about sort of about 3 or 4 men high. And that's in honour of the US helping to fight Japan in World War II.
Oh.
They have a tower bridge in Suzhou. It can't raise, which seems to defeat the purpose somewhat,
yeah,
I think. And it has 4 towers instead of 2.
I mean,
so
some bridges just have that sort of problem under pressure.
So, yes, Bridge Viagra.
We could absolutely market that.
Yeah.
And
it's a very small market, but it's lucrative.
Yeah, it's a small market, but it's growing.
It's growing. Hey. Sorry, a little bit of sicklessness. Yep.
Did someone from the Chinese government go on holiday to the Epcot Center and just go, that's what we want to do, that's what our whole country should be?
Well, funnily enough, they have a theme park called the Window of the World in Shenzhen, which contains 130 reproductions of world landmarks, including a 1/3 of the scale version of the Eiffel Tower, the pyramids, the Taj Mahal, the New York City skyline, which still includes the Twin Towers, the Sydney Opera House, and then my favourite thing, Uluru and the Matterhorn, not man-made landmarks, just versions of mountains.
Okay. Imagine though, if you have a sort of replica in New York that predates 2001, like of any kind. Imagine the macabre operation that would be removing the Twin Towers.
Yes.
Everyone would say, no, I'm not doing it.
Yeah. And if we're going to do it, how are we doing it?
Yeah.
We're
going
to get a model aeroplane.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
And we're going to get some tiny Lego men to jump into.
Oh, no. Oh, God.
The landmark it has from the UK in this theme park has the Palace of Westminster, Buckingham Palace, Tower Bridge, Stonehenge, and from what I can tell from one picture, the Uffingdon White Horse.
Oh, okay.
Which I didn't believe had travelled sort of as widespreadly as those other ones.
They didn't.
Sorry.
Oh, they didn't go for what's the big chalk man massive dong?
Yes, the Sir Nevis Giant.
Yes,
that's it.
Didn't go for that instead.
No, not the one with the erection. Just the galloping
the family, horse. Only the family friendly chalk drawings on hillsides.
you guys are going to talk about films. I'm actually going to talk about TV. America specializes in terrible reboots of British comedies.
Mm-hmm.
Notably, I'm going to mention there's the IT Crowd where they basically recreated it shot for shot.
Yeah, it's amazing.
You can watch there's a split screen video. You can watch them side by side identically they try and reproduce it. And I don't see the point of if you're going to reproduce the script entirely, why you need to just why you don't just show the original version of this.
Especially if you're going to go to the trouble of cloning Richard Ayoade and casting him in both.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They have a non-sweary version of The Thick of It before Veep came out, and they actually made it's another great version of The Thick of It. They tried a pilot with a non-sweary version and it did not work, and Monica Iannucci was horrified. But we were talking, Tom and I were mentioning beforehand, that for something to really be a bad remake, it has to nearly ruin the reputation of the original.
Mm.
And the original has to be something totemic, iconic. And if you want the best sitcom ever, it's got to be Fawlty Towers, doesn't it? Ben's turning a page to some notes that he's also taken. And the Americans have tried and tried and tried and tried again to make versions of Fawlty Towers over the years to very little avail. They started very shortly after Fawlty Towers first aired with a show called Snavely with Betty White in it.
Snavely.
Which didn't get past the pilot.
And also Harvey Korman.
And Harvey Korman,
who
was
Hedy Lamarr in Blazing Saddles.
Yes.
Like, one of my favourite comedy performances ever.
He's good American Manuel. John Cleese casting.
Betty White is the John Cleese type.
Oh, they inverted it in that one as well.
Yeah. Because a few years later they created Amanda's, Amanda's by the Sea, which starred Bea Arthur. This was both, coincidentally, before the Golden Girls. Both of them were these two remakes. And she was, again, she was running a hotel in California, not by the sea, even though it was called Amanda's by the Sea.
Right.
And someone told her when they watched it, you're not really playing anything. And John Cleese explained why. Because basically they'd given all of Basil and Sybil's lines to one character. They'd given them all to be Arthur.
So lots of arguing with yourself over money and music and
all that stuff. 1997, they tried again in the weirdest departure. They created a sitcom called Over the Top with Tim Curry. And Tim Curry doesn't really play a hotel owner. He's an out-of-work English actor who's staying and skiving off a friend's hotel in New York City.
Oh.
It also features an early career Steve Carell.
Mm-hmm. Wow, okay.
Yeah, as the chef, Yorgo, who's sort of the Manuel type character in it. TV's Peter Coe wrote a review of the show and he bashed Tim Curry quite heavily. And then he said, "I have stood in a freezer full of dead people at the morgue. I have seen a man's scalp pulled back over his nose. I've even seen 35 minutes of Ellen DeGeneres' Mr. Wrong. But I can now honestly say that until Steve Carell's turn in the premiere of Over the Top, I have never known true horror."
Oh, good.
It also debuted opposite the World Series, which probably didn't help.
Oh, my God. Well, they got off light then because no one was watching.
Yeah. And the final, most recent attempt was a show called Payne in 1999, starring John Larroquette as Royal Payne. Hilarious.
Uh-huh.
And his wife, Connie, full name Constance Payne.
Mm-hmm.
With Mo, an Indian bellhop, again in the Manuel type role.
Danger, Will Robinson.
Played by an Indian.
Not as foreign as his name would suggest.
Okay,
he's called,
what's he called?
Rick Batalla, which doesn't sound the most Indian of names. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They could reboot that with Tom Hardy doing his Welsh accent.
Yeah. They aired, this is the one that seems to have been the most successful. They aired 8 of the 9 episodes. The problem with this one is it like sort of slammed various plots of Fawlty Towers episodes together.
Ooh.
Episode 5 was called Pacific Ocean Duck, which was a sort of a mashup of the Kipper and the Corpse episode and Gourmet Night.
Oh.
It suffers mostly from the fact that they don't commit to making the Basil character as dislikable or as highly strung as they would have. They make them sort of the snide, snarky, American, slightly know-it-all type character with none of the I'm having a breakdown-ness that John Cleese brings to it.
Also, I remember in TV Historian, in that domain, Fawlty Towers is criticised frequently for having uncomplicated and incredibly clear plots, so I'm really glad they fixed that in the American.
Yeah, by putting it all together. Yeah, well, the thing is... Every episode of Fawlty Towers is a farce in and of itself. It's sort of, there's a central thing of you don't want the guests to see the dead body, and the whole story is... then how you increasingly making it more difficult to hide the dead body, or you don't want the inspector to see the rat. And then the whole episode is 30 minutes of trying to keep that plate spinning.
When you think about it, the best American remake of Fawlty Towers is Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yes. Yeah, it's probably true.
Yeah.
For my candidate for the world's worst remake, I think I'm going to do all 4 of the American versions of Fawlty Towers.
So all 4 of them?
All 4.
That's quite hard to tussle with.
That is a club sandwich of awfulness.
Yeah. What I have is less spectacularly poor, but what I'm kind of making the case for is that this is a bad remake in that what it is, it's two films, and the film remake version. What it does is take a singular and incredible source material and make all the reverse decisions to what made the original good. So the remake I'm talking about is the 1999 remake of The Haunting. Which starred, among other people, Liam Neeson, Catherine Zeta-Jones,
yes.
And Lily...
Oh. Lily. Okay. Sorry, Lily, that was Lily. Just for Harvey, Harvey Gorman Lily. Fans.
Lily Taylor was playing the main character. And Owen Wilson's in it as well.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So I'll tell you a bit more about it. So they're both based on The Haunting of Hill House, which is a novel by Shirley Jackson. And so the basic plot is, in the original film and in the book, a psychologist is sort of trying to... Well, he's kind of an occultist. He's trying to figure out whether anything like ESP or the supernatural really exists. So he concocts this plan where he recruits people who claim to have experienced episodes of ESP or unexplained phenomena. And so he sends an advert out, basically puts a call in the newspaper, says, have you experienced anything like this? Please get in touch. His whole plan is to try and see what happens if you put all these people who radiate some kind of psychic energy or seem to be able to commune with another world, put them in the most haunted house reported to be in America. Will that bring more phenomena out? Spoilers, guys, it sure does. So the main character in the remake and in the original film and the book is Eleanor. Renamed Nell in the remake, and she
three
is
three syllables are just too many.
I know, right? I mean, it's got to be all cool in 90s.
Yeah. Also, so... but Nell, like Death Nell. Am I right, guys?
Her first name is Death. So,
oh god, I'm just like imagining the moment someone came up with that in the script meetings, and everyone went, "Let's just take lunch, guys. We're done.
Yeah,
for
we're
the
done.
Day.
Everyone just pats themselves on the back for the next hour, and then they have sandwiches.
Yeah.
I have cemented my place in the C-grade writers' rooms of Hollywood.
punch-up career for me for the rest of my life. The whole idea is that she is living with... Well, her mother's just died, and her mother was an invalid for the last many years of her life, and she was landed with... Already being quite a reclusive and not very social person, she was tasked with looking after this quite abusive and very demanding invalid mother. So the mother then dies, and in the will... pretty much everything is there's some dispute over who runs it. So basically the decision is that that Eleanor's sister and her husband will take over it because they have a family, they have kids, whereas Eleanor's just kind of on her own, and the idea is like, well, they need this more because they have a sort of family to bring up. And Eleanor is living with them as their sort of resented lodger. They give her no respect. She doesn't really like living with the arsehole kids who are in both film versions portrayed as unrepentant jerks. And so that's where we open. And so she sees this this advert, and we don't really learn at first what phenomena she has experienced or whether she really truly has at the beginning of the story, but we know that she's lonely and she wants somewhere she can belong. So she sort of decides, I can go do this thing, I'll have a bonding experience with people, and I will be part of an adventure. I want to have a real experience in my life, an adventure of some kind. So the only people who've bothered to turn up are Eleanor and this lady Theo. She appears to have proper cold reading skills, a proper sort of psychic intuition, ESP. And everyone else is too terrified to come because everyone hears where this experiment's happening, and the reputation of Hill House is so severe for hauntings and disturbing events that no one else will come. So the only people left in the house are those two women, the doctor, and the sort of playboy fella who is, I believe, considering buying the house or has inherited it from his mad uncle who used to own it. And so it's just those four in the house, and things unravel. So in the remake, the sort of cocky playboy character is Owen Wilson, at full 90s Owen Wilson. And he's not really involved with the house. He's not inherited it. He's not that involved with the house. It's just that he's another guy who turns up. He's cannon fodder, basically. And if anything, they leave it far too long to kill him. So he turns up. And so you've met Catherine Zeta-Jones.
I mean, to be fair, any film that has cocky playboy in haunted house has cocky playboys about to get killed.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, I don't want to say anything about the 63 film because you should watch it. But anyway, so he's that guy. He's kind of an unnecessary character. Owen Wilson does quite well in it. All the actors do quite well, especially Lily Taylor playing Eleanor. And the original 1963 film, I'm just going to double check that, but the novel's from 1959 and the movie came out in 63. Back then, of course, there's very little effects budget. There's not much you can really do with any sort of computer-generated or green screen effects. So the entire film hangs on the constant tension and the creepy atmosphere and the sort of worry that You have a beautiful monologue, internal monologue from Eleanor as her sort of mental state gradually degrades and she becomes more and more sort of infatuated with the Doctor, more frightened by the others and more dependent on this idea of belonging. And you get the impression that whatever spirit is in the house is preying on that idea. One of the coolest things about the book and the 63 film is that Theo, the psychic, is clearly meant to be gay. And they can't say it for various sort of censorship reasons or maybe not trying to offend people at that time, in the late 50s, early 60s. But it's made very, very clear sort of through innuendo that she is absolutely 100% lesbian and can't talk about it in polite society. And there's a real inherent tragedy to the character that's very moving, especially because she kind of likes Eleanor, but Eleanor is incredibly sexually repressed and socially repressed in every way. So is constantly sort of trying to keep her away.
Yeah.
And it's but still somehow you get the impression that actually in different circumstances, this could happen. This could be a thing and might be exactly the salvation that Eleanor's been looking for all this time. In the remake, Catherine Zeta-Jones plays Theo. She's not psychic in the least. She's also bisexual. She admits that very early on. It never comes up again. It's not an issue. It's not important. There's some mild flirtation between her and Eleanor. It's not relevant to the plot. It doesn't matter, and nothing ever comes of it. And the problem with that is you have a character whose inherent tragedy only applied to one time in history, and your sort of great tribute to that statement that was made in the original thing is to in no way engage with
it. Is Catherine Zeta-Jones going, I once lesed up at college when I was 16?
It really is like that. It's like there's a little flirty line where someone says, like, oh, I try and keep a few people on the on the line at a time. And she goes, like, oh, does your boyfriend approve of that? And she's like, my boyfriend doesn't, but my girlfriend does. Like, naughty Catherine Zeta-Jones by Curious. And it's just pure titillation, whereas in the original, it's really like you feel a kind of pain to it.
One thing that I think is a common thread in a lot of the sort of cultural suggestions we have on Worst Foot Forward is a total fucking lack of nuance. As I displayed there in my anger at it.
The ghost, if it really matters, is supposed to be this guy called Hugh Crane.
I'd love him to have a girlfriend called Bella Roos.
Bella Roos, yeah, Crane. His wife, yeah. So you know, it's this whole thing, and so there's numerous sort of terrible events that happen to real people in the house, and a number of unexplained suicides and accidents that are in the sort of 100-year-ago past of this house.
It's got a little bit of a health and safety gone wrong aspect
to it
as well.
It could just be that. So my main complaint about the remake, so the original, what's amazing about it is that it's all tension. Yeah. The scariest moment in the entire film, and it's terrifying and you will feel a chill go up your spine, is when a door is open that shouldn't be open. That's it. Like, that's the most frightening bit. Yeah. And in the remake, there are so many ghosts, you guys. Like, it was Yann DuBont, known for Twister and Speed, very good action film effects film director, was tasked with this. He turned it into basically The Mummy, but in a haunted house. So you have huge CGI ghosts, you have a number of, now holding up reasonably well, but a little plasticky looking CGI appearances, like the face of sort of a ghost child in a curtain. It's quite creepy. But the problem is what he decided that pretty much everything that made the film adaptation of the book really brilliant, he was going to flip completely on its back and do the exact opposite.
Yeah, people seem to misunderstand that in horror, that it's not the ghost itself that's the terrifying thing. It's the prospect of the ghost.
Exactly. And if anything, once you actually realise, and there's a great sort of, you know, Hugh Crane himself appears at the end of, spoilers, the end of the 1999 movie in this big CGI The Mummy showdown.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, that looks cool and this is quite nicely directed. But you go, well, it's not frightening.
Because you've seen so many ghosts up to this point.
Yeah, true. But also it's an acknowledged villain. Once you see a clear image of the baddie, it's not frightening anymore. It's just an adversary to be conquered in some way. And you never get that catharsis or that resolution in The Haunting.
Yeah.
It's pure terror and it's pure fear.
Yeah.
So if the 1963 Haunting is about fear, the 1999 one is about ghosts! Everywhere ghosts! All the ghosts coming out of the wall, they're coming out of the fireplace, they're coming out of the floor, they're coming out of the beautifully decorated ornate fireplace mantle, you know, the children's faces are coming to life, oh my god! And all of the sort of mystique of the original. In many more ways, which I'm happy to elaborate on, but also all these little tiny decisions just amount to a really sort of milky pudding of just haunted house, nothing.
Oh my god. That's a damning review. Yeah.
Horror films, particularly in those sort of sci-fi films, seem to come in for. Because have you seen The Wicker Man?
Yeah, I thought about that
Nick
one.
Nick Cage version.
Yeah, it's such well-trodden comic fodder. Yeah, I didn't want to talk about it.
It's too obvious, but
sparklingly
the bees,
terrible.
The bees.
Yeah,
the bees.
He gets a load of bees poisoned.
Have you not
the mask
seen this?
He's wearing. So, we're going to do this, we're going to show you this scene.
The Wicker Man remake, okay, so Edward Woodward goes to his remote Scottish island. That's the Wicker Man.
Iwa Woowa
goes to Summer Isle. That's the thing. And their thing is they grow apples. The fear is if they don't do a human sacrifice, they'll lose their apples. Now, in the remake, he goes to a small island, which is, for no reason, entirely run by women. Imagine the horror. And they're a community that make honey. And so they're worried about the sort of the honey harvest. Maybe the director or the adapter thought, oh, the bees are dying. That's a good thing to talk about in the horror movie. But it leads to this scene.
For the audience at home, we will not be able to broadcast us listening the audio from this, but we will be able to broadcast Ben's reaction to it.
Yes.
I'm going to say that Nicolas Cage going, oh God, the bees, is right up there with Darth Vader's at the end of episode 3.
Also, hey man, don't worry. That is not even the dumbest thing in the movie.
What's the dumbest thing in the movie?
The dumbest thing in the movie is when Nicolas Cage kind of loses his rag in a kind of similar way, like he sort of tips past the point of redemption, like Edward Woodward's character does.
Oh, yeah.
One part of that is he has sort of an infiltrate the pagan procession near the end where they're going to sacrifice this little girl and he's going to save the little girl. And in the modern version, he's dressed as a bear in a full-on, like I would say, quite
Scooby-Doo
decent...
Scooby-Doo outfit.
Yeah, kind of, but better. Like, he looks like an actual bear on its hind legs. Walks up to a woman and punches her with his costume bear claw, knocking her out in one go.
With his bare hand.
And you're convinced you want to suggest The Haunting.
I'm going to suggest The Haunting.
The thing is, The Wicker Man is so funny in a completely unintentional way that it's too good to, in that sense.
There's a scary section. There's a little creepy little set piece where Nicolas Cage thinks he hears something inside a scary barn. Whoa. And so he goes into the scary barn. He thinks he hears something upstairs in the scary barn. So he goes up the creepy wooden creaking steps of the barn. Walks through with his little torch in the dark in the nighttime, and he goes, oh no, what's going on? And then he falls through the rotting wooden floor of the first floor of this barn, lands on his back, creeped out and like winded. End of scene. It was literally like to fill 5 to 10 minutes of film.
That part of the movie's reached its natural conclusion there, right?
Yeah, well, kind of, yeah.
They thought the ambulance arriving and him spending some time in hospital would be a bit much.
Ow.
That Family Guy gag.
Ooh, yeah, that quite hurts.
Oh, smart.
Yeah.
trying to put his jumper on the next day. Can we lift that? Could someone help me?
Have I cracked a rib? No, you're sure that it's okay. We put it back in. It's going to hurt for like 2 days. Oh, shit. It's really high stakes horror.
Computer games.
Oh, yeah.
There's a couple of absolute stinkers.
Yeah, I've read some of these.
There is a remake of a Sonic game.
Yes, I've seen this.
That makes no sense.
please do tell.
Obviously, what you want from Sonic is Sonic to collect rings, fight a Soviet robot dictator, and see as little of Tails as is fucking possible.
Three little furry creatures.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. What you don't want is Sonic to have a love interest who is a human called Princess Elise.
Oh, man.
Who is possessed by a time-travelling science demon.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a scene where they are running through the fields together in a romantic way, and later on, Sonic is lying on an altar like some sort of hedgehog Aslan, and she gives him the kiss of life in a beautiful romantic moment that is thundering bobbins.
Wow.
So that's pretty awful.
I bet the Parents Council of America had some stuff to say.
Guys, just send the hedgehog around the race course and I'll collect the rings
all
for you.
All
you
gotta do
fine.
Is jump.
Yeah, and then you will, inevitably, after loads of unnecessary setup.
Yeah.
We gotta go fast.
There is no need for plot and backstory in Sonic the Hedgehog. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Mario does it really well, where it sort of gives you bigger enemies and bigger crazy scenarios, but it doesn't actually give you long, drawn-out dialogue and unnecessary mythos. It's all just little tidbits of fun. Big Turtle, the end.
Yeah, done. Wonderful.
The thing is, you'd log on to a Sonic game. I can remember Sonic the Hedgehog, turning it on the Sega Mega Drive. There was no need for setup. The game would load. You'd go to the Green Hill Zone or whatever the first thing was called.
Yep.
And you would literally just start running to the right.
Yeah, you're on the left of the screen. You want to go right.
Yeah. You didn't need any explanation.
No one has ever played Sonic and halfway through gone, oh, but what's my motivation?
Yeah. Yes.
Although, actually...
Guys, we need a non-geographic location and a kitchen implement.
Okay, so it's the spatula lead works. Okay, that's our new Sonic level. Great. Okay.
It's really... And also, if you were going to have a bestiality subplot, if you...
Yes, Ben.
Yeah, I was... If I was going to fuck a computer-generated animal...
Yes, Ben.
It wouldn't be a hedgehog.
Oh, yeah.
Sub-question, do hedgehogs have spiny penises?
Sub-answer, no.
They probably have bacula in them.
What's bacula?
The bone in them that most mammals have in their penises.
Oh, yes, of course.
Oh, an actual bone?
Yeah.
Oh.
Most mammals, apart from humans, have them.
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, poor buggers. Because it's hard enough, like, dressing to one side or the other when you don't have a bone in your penis.
Yes, yeah. In fact, badgers' penis bones were tended to be used in... I think it was badgers' penis bones. It may be another one. You tend to be used as tie pins. Back in the old days. The look on my friend's face is
just the dead silence of just contemplation. Yeah.
I think that the badger cull is probably just a ploy by the Tory party to get more cheap tie pins.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, and they'll get them.
Yeah, they will. Let me call the canary now. That'll get me a headline immediately.
The guys, ISIS just hates our propensity for penis badger tie pins. That's why they attack us. There's nothing to do with our foreign intervention. It's just the tie-pins made of badger's dicks.
I'm pretty certain that penis badger tie-pin is a horrible Japanese translation of the animals of farthing wood.
That is, yeah. And that is actually my second favourite Pixies album.
I mean, if you were going to sleep with a computer game character, who would it be?
Yeah.
Mine is definitely Link from The Legend of Zelda.
Yeah, okay.
He's really sexy.
Yeah. Not when he's a little boy, though.
But he's also just in pants in the new at the start of the new Zelda game.
Cool.
I would go for the iteration of Ray Wilkins in Championship Manager 2.
Okay.
Because he has 1 speed, 15 stamina, and 20 flair.
Nice. Pac-Man.
Because he can gobble down.
Because he swallows. Quick.
Yeah.
It's all he does all day. All day, all night.
Nom, 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 nom.
Yeah. But then you turn into a ghost if he succeeds.
And then you end up in a remake of The Haunting.
No!
How did I get here?
I wouldn't have been surprised if Inky, Blinky, Pinky, or the other one turned
Clyde.
Up in...
Clyde.
Turned up in The Haunting. Because they just had so many ghosts, they ran out. Sorry, back on topic. I'd fuck Pac-Man so hard. So hard all day, all night. Moving on.
That's the trailer for the show. So yeah.
Sorry, so you wanted to tell us about more video game remakes, Ben. Did you have any follow-up questions on me fucking Pac-Man, like positions or ideal circumstances?
Where do you put it?
Does he have an anus?
I don't know. I've never seen... He's always been in 2D.
Hey, I'll find out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because there's no extra game of, like, Pac-Man just pooping out ghost after ghost after ghost after pill.
That's a point. No, he does.
That's reassuring. He won't have to douche.
Wait a second. He does. He poos out ghost eyes.
Oh, yeah,
Because when you eat... When you make the ghosts vulnerable and you eat them... Out the back of him come the ghost's eyes that go back to
Central
Office.
Can you imagine
office?
Taking Pac-Man for a walk and having to scoop up after and just hang around
eyes.
A whole bag of ghost eyes?
Hang on, Pac-Man's not your pet.
In my world, he's a gimp.
I lead him around on a lead. And then you make him clean
And then
the
I
house.
Take him home and Tom fucks him.
Yeah.
How does Mrs. Hole? Pac-Man feel about this?
She watches.
Wasn't her name Ms. Pac-Man? So are they not technically not married?
Or she's just a third-wave feminist.
Yeah,
maybe they're brother and sister.
Could be.
I'd made a huge assumption there. I'm totally sorry.
I think canonically she is supposed to be his wife or girlfriend, to be fair. And she is absolutely
invited. I mean, girlfriend,
invited.
It's... Well, then they've got a whole, like, oh, our surnames are already Pac-Man.
Mm. Well, unless that's... Pac-Man might be, like, a description of the thing that they are. So his name might be, like, Alan Jenkins. But he is a Pac-Man. And she's
Pac-Man.
A Ms. Pac-Man, and her name is Felicia Nightgarden.
But if she's quite feminist, though.
Yeah.
She's, like, doesn't like being called... Like, an actress who doesn't like to be called an actress wants to be called an actress. Like,
yeah.
I want to be called a
Pac-Man.
Not a Ms. Pac-Man.
Yeah, either that or they are like creepy incestuous brother and sister, and their names are like Steve Pac-Man
Steve
and
Pac-Man.
Alicia Pac-Man.
You're now just making me think of Gene Hackman.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, I want to fuck Pac-Man and Gene Hackman. Can we please just get back to the topic of famous actors and video game characters that I would have sex with? That's what this is, right?
That was sponsored by Gosh Comics.
Gosh Comics for all your comic needs. We've got weeklies, graphic novels, fantastic helpful staff.
Go on, Ben.
I've lost the will to live.
Fair enough.
the other remake of a video game that is entirely unnecessary because, again, it took an absolute classic and brought... So here's the thing. You know how with a lot of modern superhero movies, they've remade them fine, they've rebooted them fine, they've given them grit. That's my issue with all of the Christopher Nolan and DC Comics one. There's unnecessary grit. Space Invaders, a game which is perfect in every way and can remain in 2D like Pac-Man. Obviously, I know which Space Invader you'd go for. It's the one with all the different arms. Oh, he's got you coming and going in every direction.
No, it's too complicated for me. I want a sphere.
You want a sphere?
Okay. Basic sphere. I want
the spaceship. I mean, look how far that thing can shoot.
I would respond, but I don't want to carry on this conversation anymore. So,
fuck this podcast. We're doing 4 hours of hide. Fuck Pac-Man.
So I'd also fuck this podcast.
Yeah. So they've taken Space Invaders and taken it away from the two-dimensional world of Space Invaders and Pac-Man.
And space,
and turned it into a city guerrilla warfare, three-dimensional game where you basically are consistently stuck down an alleyway and are trapped down the back and having to fire away at the Space Invaders. Yep. There is also another cutscene in it where there's a fucking shower scene that looks not with one of the Space Invaders.
So they took a game that was about a little white thing firing missiles at green incoming aliens, and it somehow still managed to get a shower scene with a busty lady in there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's incredible.
So obviously we have to go into the world of films. Let's just reel a couple off that we're not going to talk about. We're not going to talk about Planet of the Apes.
Which one of them?
Like, no,
the Tim Burton one.
The Tim Burton one. We're not talking about sequels.
Yeah.
That is a different podcast. We're talking about remakes. We're not going to talk about the god... damn awful chocolatey abortion that is Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
God.
Like, that is the beginning of the end for Johnny Depp. My main issue with that film is the Willy Wonka is broken because his dad was a dentist who never loved him subplot.
Yeah, no, yeah, I don't.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
I don't want a Willy Wonka backstory.
No, the gritty backstory of Willy Wonka.
No, I mean, it upsets me that Roald Dahl didn't like the Gene Wilder remake. I can only imagine how much he would have hated this 2006 or whatever version.
Yeah.
But we got to get to the main event, which Barry alluded to 5 days and 17 Pac-Man jokes ago. It is Psycho.
Yeah.
Remade, in 1998 by Gus Van Sant.
Mm.
They say it is. The people who make the things that you adore who hurt you the most, like with Fawlty Towers.
Yeah. Mm.
Gus Van Sant came to prominence making Good Will Hunting, which is one of my favourite films of all time.
Yeah.
And I just want to say, Gus, it is your fault. It is your fault. It is your fucking fault, you scumbag. He took all of his movie credentials and fame and goodwill, took the goodwill from Good Will Hunting, and made a baffling shot-for-shot remake of a cinematic classic. He is basically taking the Mona Lisa and repainting it in fucking crayons and watercolours.
He's getting that lady from Spain.
Yeah, exactly. let me just tell you about some of the cast in it.
Right.
You have Anne Hesh, playing the Janet Leigh role. You have William H. Macy as the detective in it.
Yeah.
He's the least shit thing in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You have Viggo Mortensen as the other love interest, and Julianne Moore really ruining her credentials. But top of the list of why this movie should not have been remade, in the role of Norman Bates, you have Vince Vaughn.
Yeah. No.
Yes.
No, he didn't.
Yes, he did.
No, Ben, no, you're lying.
I'm absolutely not. Taking a break from starring in movies with your pal, Owen Wilson.
Yeah, Owen Wilson and also Jon Favreau, let's not forget. This is the heyday of Swingers. Who watches Swingers and go, you know who he should play? Norman Bates.
Well, Gus Van Sant, clearly.
Yeah.
Firstly, the shot-for-shot remake is such a film student wank job. It's utterly unnecessary in every way. He does the trick that your pal in The Haunting did. He removes every single bit of tension from the entire movie and then adds in unnecessary little things. For example, Julianne Moore at one point talks about having to go get her Walkman. Like, that doesn't need that. That is one of the few added lines that you just don't need
But how would we know it was set today? If you didn't go. Yeah.
But this picture's in colour. I don't know if it's in the past or not.
Ah, my mobile's dead. Ah, but it is set now.
But I'm not. Yet.
Look at camera. Yeah. Did he put lots of like cheesy one-liners and looks into camera? Because then I would watch it.
Sadly not. Aww. Sadly not in any way. Another way that they've really updated it for the fizzing pre-millennial era is that the soundtrack consists almost entirely of drum and bass, where the titles of the songs are to do with psychopaths or murders. They, and similar to the Haunting, they added things that were unnecessary. So one of the creepiest scenes in the original movie is when Norman Bates spies on, I've forgotten the name of the...
I can never remember.
...of the female protagonist, but Janet Leigh's the actress. Mm. He spies on her, and it's really quite disturbing and unsettling and voyeuristic. In this one, they get rid of all nuance, and Vince Vaughn is definitely having a hand shandy while he's watching that. Yeah. I'm going to go to the greatest reviewer takedown on this is Roger Ebert.
Oh, friend of the show, Roger Ebert.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, rest in peace.
Roger Ebert describes the added wanking scene as appropriate, because this new version of Psycho evokes the real thing in an attempt to recreate a remembered passion. He also describes the movie as though a provincial stock company was doing their best without the Broadway cast. But the lack of nuance, and I quote here from this article from the AV Club, it'd be like remaking Citizen Kane, but changing the protagonist's last words to Rosebud, which incidentally was the last name of my childhood sled and represents a lost childhood Eden of innocence and purity that throws the materialist emptiness of my adulthood into even sharper relief. Alas, I've said too much, and now I must die, mysteriously or not. The nominees are four American remakes of Fawlty Towers. If at first you don't succeed, try again and make it even worse. Yeah. Tom's suggestion of The Haunting, or narrowly beating Tom Crowley's Pac-Man fan fiction.
Yes.
Is
guys, that's got a lot of literary merit.
It really does.
Don't start doing that down now.
I'm not going to choose my suggestion just because I would have chosen Psycho if I loved the original. And it's a very, very good film, but it's just not my bag. So for that reason, because it hasn't offended me that much, as awful as it is, I can't choose that. Similarly, you make a real solid case for The Haunting, Tom.
I feel like I'm not going to take it.
But
would it help if I said again how much I love the original?
I understand that you care so much about the original source material, but I think there are so many films that have sort of spayed off that original. Like there's the House on Haunted Hill and the 13th House and shit like that.
Yeah.
Which are all awful remakes of that one, and there's not one definitive one. Whereas, A, we all work in the comedy industry, and I think we all love and adore Fawlty Towers, and they are 12 nuggets of farcical perfection. And the Americans just need to learn when to keep their grubby hands off our crown jewels. And so because of that, because it was so badly miscast, because it was so badly remade, and because Steve Carell then goes from zero to hero in the remakes, I think that is absolutely the winner.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, absolutely. Congratulations. Did you know that The Fawlty Towers itself was accused of being a remake?
Vaguely.
You better see the rejection letter that came from like the head BBC commissioner.
Yes, it's derivative, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, he says, we don't need a remake of The Prince of Denmark, which was a Ronnie Corbett sitcom, set in the hotelier industry, which is what this is.
There's been a programme about the hotels.
Yeah.
There can't be another.
This guy's like just sort of rip-off of Ronnie Corbett. This John Cleese guy.
The BBC ever with its finger on the comedic pulse.
On the pulse, on the pulse.
It is time, before we go our separate ways, for the worst news of the week. And this news comes from the coast of Australia, where for the first time since 1873...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a fishing boat has pulled up a faceless fish. This is on an expedition where they also pulled up items from the animal kingdom known as the coffin fish, blind sea spiders, deep sea eels, and other things from your nightmares.
Right.
What it actually is a cusk eel, and there's no other way to describe it other than looking like a giant phallus.
Right. Like a xenomorph.
But more so.
Right, okay.
It apparently does have tiny, tiny, tiny little eyes. and a mouth that is underneath. It's sort of like a stingray's is, but it just looks like utterly disgusting.
Wait, so it's not spherical?
It's not spherical.
No, I'm not interested.
Good, that's a relief all around then. It's, I mean, basically, if John Woo was going to remake Face Off for deep sea aquamarine life, then it would be impossible with this fish. It's so ugly and so terrifying. And what made me most angry about it is that when a journalist asked the marine biologist what was the taxonomic name for it, they went, well, it's very easy. The name for a fish with no eyes is a fish.
That old joke.
That old joke. So not only is it horrifying, but it made a marine biologist think they could do our job. No, you can't. So before we all toddle off, Tom, where can people find you online and what can they find you doing there?
Apart from the fanfiction.com Pac-Man fanfiction. Well, I'm in, as you very kindly mentioned, I do two podcasts at the moment. I'm going to plug three things, is that okay, for the podcast fans? Well, firstly, we've got two series of Wooden Overcoats, which is a podcast sitcom, the first ever like fully studio-produced British podcast sitcom, about two rival undertakers on a Channel Island, which is, we've got two series out already and some mini-episodes, you can find them. We're currently releasing a monthly podcast called Story Etc., which is all about fiction in all media, so it's interviews and also original radio plays in an anthology, like a 1 hour per episode chunky travel listen. And I've also just finished recording a new podcast, a comedy steampunk detective drama thing. Cool. So imagine sort of very Adamsian kind of murder mystery set in an alternative steampunk Victorian London.
Is that what it's called?
It is, yeah. Well, basically it is, because the title is Victoriosity, and that should be coming out later in 2017.
That sounds smashing, and I can attest to Wooden Overcoat being bloody excellent.
Thank you.
So
very
do
much.
Give it a listen.
Lovely people.
Right. We are all off to pitch a remake of Fawlty Towers. Hooray. Starring Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson.
Oh, we're going to do it. They're a couple.
Yeah.
Well, Owen Wilson is Sybil.
Oh, God. Whilst Tom is off to have some dark thoughts about Pac-Man.
I'm off to the arcade.
Play with your joystick.
Yeah, make sure the screen is laminated. Right. Until next week. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Buddy, good to have you.
Thanks, man.
God, I've missed you.
I've missed you too. It's been a tough month.
Congratulations on your Edinburgh Award. And now another take, just in case. Commiserations on a long, hard month. And now somewhere in the middle. I'm glad it's been an average Edinburgh for you.
That's all the bases covered.
Yeah, we'll edit around that.
Yeah, we will. I mean, literally, because today's the 28th of August, so I have spent this morning on watching the sunrise on a monument with former pod guests Paul Flannery and James Rowland, I imagine.
Yes.
And then I have driven back to London.
Especially to record this.
Especially to record this, borderline illegally. And now I might be off to go and do comedy at my comedy club in Kilburn against all medical advice. And then I'm going to sleep for a week.
Thank you very much, Tom, for joining us and taking us down memory lane with some terrible, terrible remakes. If you enjoyed Tom, go to his website, Crowley & Co., because aside from his own work, he produces lots of other people's stuff. He's worked with Gemma Arrowsmith, previous guest friend of the show, and all of that.
He is also the better half of Gemma Arrowsmith.
I didn't know if that was public domain.
Yeah, well, and also worked with is a horrible euphemism of being in a romantic relationship.
Yes, I work with my husband all the time. We have regular meetings, peer reviews.
I really don't want a peer review with my wife.
We've got a PA handling all of our meetings. As ever, we are going to now beg for your love and affection. Give us ratings and reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to us. We'd also like you to follow us on Twitter at WorstFoot. Ben is on at Ben Vandeveld, and I'm at BazMaxStay. And send us an email, worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com, if you have suggestions of guests, topics, or you want to say hi to Ben and welcome him back as well. We were going to have a parade. In fact, all the listeners on the show wanted to get... We're going to have a parade, little marching band, school children with papier-mâché heads of your face on them to welcome you back to London. But this is the worst podcast in the
world. Yeah, it is. So I wanted a ticker tape parade, and instead Barry just threw a toilet roll at my head.
Oh, dude, I just got a cassette. It was completely useless.
Thanks, man. So next week, we have got a good pal, another cracking comedian, and former weatherman on 90s TV show The Big Breakfast.
Yes.
We've joined by Simon Fielder, who's going to talk to us about the world's worst gadget.
Simon is the first guest to bring gifts.
Yeah.
Tune in next week to find out what he brings us. Disappointingly, not iPhones.